It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, episode 85.
Bringing a whole new meaning to a global superpower.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have with us today Mike Cole. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No problem. I'm not even sure where to start since we just spent like an hour bantering.
I think we should start with sincere regrets that bantering was not recorded and broadcast.
Well, we'll make sure that the next time we have you on the show, we'll record that. And we'll use it as blackmail.
Our next episode will be the Mike Cole interviews Skippy and Fanty.
This is going to be a heck of a lot more interesting than Skippy and Fanty interviews Mike Cole.
We should do that, though. That does sound like fun.
Dude, I'm telling you, I will absolutely volunteer to do that. I am rapidly becoming the busiest man on Earth. I will make time for that.
Awesome. So let's start here. The stock question, which is telling us a bit about yourself, particularly sort of what drew you into writing and why writing fantasy and not like sexy romances or something.
It's funny you should mention, I just did a guest blog post for a pretty well-known romance author named Shiloh Walker, stating my very serious intention to eventually get around to writing sexy romances.
That sounds hot.
I'm kind of bugged by the fact that it's a field in which when men do write, they write under pseudonyms. And I don't like it. I didn't like it when women had to write science fiction and fantasy under pseudonyms. And examples of that are Andre Norton and Robin Hobb.
So James Tiptree.
Yep. So I don't see why that should apply to the romance genre either. And that's a barrier I'd love to be part of breaking. So once I get my career up and running and I've learned a little bit more about the genre and really feel ready to do it, it's definitely something I'm going to turn my hand to.
I should be respectful of that answer, but I think that's hilarious and awesome.
I strive for hilarity in all that I do.
The sort of reverse sexism that, you know, of course, I'm chick. I'm not going to ever think about that. Yeah, there's plenty of women in romance. Who cares if there's no guys? And yet I will whine constantly about how there aren't enough women writing science fiction. So.
And Sean, look how awesome. I just hijacked your interview question. Like, this was not where you intended it to go when we're talking about romance on the Skippy and Fanty Show.
I don't know where this assumption that I am like an order person, like everything has to be ordered. I just want us to be prepared.
I'm the military officer. I'm the law and order guy. And I'm the one who will derail every question you ask me.
I don't blame you, though.
I want to add in one thing, which is that what started me on this romance mission was I went to the Romance Writers of America RWA convention in Times Square to meet a friend. And I ride the escalator up. And I get to the convention floor and I get off the escalator. I'm looking around. I'm like, this cannot be right. Guys, I'm not kidding. There was not one guy, not one. People told me later, oh, yeah, there were three or four guys. I think there must have been 3,000 to 5,000 people at that convention. Not one guy.
That's pretty sad.
I don't know.
Sounds awesome to me.
That's what all my friends are saying. But, you know, like, I don't know.
You
like,
jackasses.
I know. Say that joke.
But the question is, of that 3,000 to 5,000 people, how many were hot chicks and how many were just old women?
I'm going to sound kind of boring, but like I really wasn't paying attention to that. I was just kind of like my brain was like locked on to what is the phenomenon here and what is the analysis and what does it mean? And I really wasn't cruising for babes, so to speak.
Sad.
I'm kind of offended by your question, Jen. Can't old ladies be hot too?
Wait, you're offended, Sean? She just called me sad.
But she implied that old ladies, like older women, cannot be sexy.
Sorry. I did not mean those as two mutually exclusive groups.
Yeah, I submit Exhibit A, Raquel Welch.
Exactly. Helen Mirren, anybody?
I was just thinking of my mind immediately went to people who I would not consider. Kathy Bates.
Back to the question, people.
Okay, so what drew you to writing fiction and why fantasy in particular?
I think writing was sort of the thing I was always good at. I don't know if your parents did this to you, but my parents were like, Coles are never good at math. You'll suck at math and suck at science. Don't even try. And, you know, when you're a little kid, you believe your parents. So I did writing and I did reading, and that was sort of my thing. And I learned to read at a very young age, and I learned to write at a very young age. And then Salon.com did an interview with myself and Peter V. Brett as part of an article written by this guy, Ethan Gilsdorth, about people growing up with D&D. And one of the things... Sorry. Did you read it?
No, I didn't. I just played D&D.
Oh. Well,
dorks.
You didn't, Sean?
I played it for a while. I was a Magic and Gathering and Rifts guy.
Oh, all right. Fair enough. As long as there's some gaming in there, then we can hang.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But D&D sort of like, you know, I was, like I think most people listening to the show, I was a scrawny nerd and I was getting my ass kicked and I was having a tough time making friends and I didn't fit in well. And D&D sort of wrapped my head around this idea that I could reinvent myself or reimagine myself because I was playing fighters and paladins in the game. And I think the first step to changing who you are is picturing it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And when you blend that with writing, so it's the one thing I'm good at. And D&D is also sort of a text game, isn't it, really? It's a lot of pencils and paper and talking and thinking. And it sort of became a natural progression, I guess.
So I think everybody kind of knows this, but you obviously served in the military and you've had a bit of experience. Could you tell us a little bit sort of about that experience?
Sure. I'm currently serving, I'd like to point out. Yeah, I'm a reservist. I do 1 week in a month and 2 weeks a year, plus whenever I get mobilized. I just got off active duty, right after Hurricane Irene. I was on active duty for 2 months and wound up responding to it down on the southern tip of the Jersey Shore. But as a matter of fact, this weekend is drill weekend. I'm going to put on my uniform and go to work. And the military experience is, I love the military. I'm a huge, huge booster for it. I'm not blind to the fact that the military's basic core function is killing people and destroying property, and that's a tough thing to wrap your head around. I'm also not blind to the fact that any giant bureaucratic organization like that has a lot of tough stuff. I mean, it's conservative, it's rigid, it everything has a rule for it. It can be a giant pain in the ass. But I think in the sum total, it's done so many great things for me and so much good in the world and given me an opportunity to do so much good in the world. And I'll tell you this, I couldn't be a full-time writer without it. I mean, the reserves is my health insurance. It's steady income. It gives me the kind of experiences that I think fill my writing with authenticity. And it's given me the personal discipline and sense of urgency and, most importantly, the ability to accept misery and suffering and bask in it even. That's enabled me to be a full-time writer. I love the military, and you're going to need a crowbar to get me out of it.
Well, I don't think we'll be kicking you out.
Good.
No, again. Yeah. That's actually an interesting sorry. I mean, this is totally personal anecdote, but I had to resolve a personal family issue with the military. My father's family were conscientious objectors, imprisoned and whatnot. My mom's family had served and everything, but I came from a pacifist upbringing. And then I met my husband. I got pregnant. We got married. And I hadn't finished college. He was a high school dropout. What do? You look for the best places that you have opportunities. And there were two. We had two options. We could either go to school, and they usually have pretty good family programs if you're going into school, or we could join the military. Well, he could. I was a slacker, so I was never going to join myself. But it really gave us the opportunity to be where we are now. And, I promote it to everybody. But I did have to go through kind of a resolution of am I okay with this? Am I okay with the fact that I am depending on this thing that I was raised to not necessarily hate but disagree with adamantly? And it was an interesting process. And then meeting the people who were in it and serving and who I have so much respect for.
There are two things you just brought up that I want to reiterate. And the first is social mobility. I mean, The military is an incredible force. It's perhaps the greatest force in this country for social mobility. I know so many kids who would be in gangs or, you know, working at McDonald's for the rest of their life, if not for the military. And they're bright kids with a lot of potential, and the military gives them a chance to break through that and to break through those barriers. And I think that often goes unremarked, and it's a very, very important thing to draw attention to. And I had one more thing to point out. Oh, the other thing is that the military is a cross section of the entire society. I just did a blog post on this very topic too about military culture, and you know, people are always like, yeah, the military only draws from, you know, the southern states, and people tend to be poor and people tend to be conservative, and all that's true. But the fact is, I have met all kinds of people in the military, including anti-authoritarian people, mavericks, dreamers, anti-government people, artists, super left-wingers. Like, the military is America, and America is the military. And when we get off work, we take off our uniforms and we go do whatever the heck everyone else is doing. And I'm willing to bet that apart from the haircut, and in some cases, not even then, you probably don't even know when you're hanging around people that are in the military. So I just don't, I really reject the idea that the military is a monoculture and that only a certain kind of people join up. That's certainly what I was led to believe by my own parents. And I'm glad that I broke through that impression.
Yeah, I mean, completely agreed, only because half the reason that we lived in Colorado for 6 years and then we moved our family back to California. But I really regretted that move in the beginning because I knew I was taking my children from, you know, a very multicultural atmosphere of a military town. It was Colorado Springs. You got 6 or 7 military bases there, and to a fairly white upper middle class neighborhood where they weren't going to be introduced to those things if I didn't make an extended effort to do so. And I loved that aspect of military life. I loved the people that we met and that my husband served with. And we always were kind of funny. I suppose it could be different between the different forces. He was Air Force. So obviously very friendly called the Chair Force for a reason, but the whole aspect that, it was to us, it was a job. To him, it was a job. It was a day job, even. I mean, even if you had rotating shifts and very structured sort of environment, at the end of the day, he still came home just like everybody else in America and had his family, and he was paying bills and everything else. And we loved that we were allowed to kind of exist in the both worlds of that's how the environment actually played out once we were in the military, because we both had totally preconceived notions of what it was to be in the military, and all of them were shattered.
Well, you have to thank my husband. You have to thank my husband. Oops.
Your husband.
Yes.
He's a good guy. You should marry him.
You have to thank him for his service. I appreciate it. The Chair Force has been the Chair Force has been very, very good to us. As a matter of fact, when we were evacuating our guys off of Cape May during the hurricane, we went to McGuire Air Force Base, which is part of the Fort Dix compound in Jersey, and the Air Force took real good care of us. So a lot of love for them.
Yeah, they're good people.
And just kind of a random point to add to this. I would imagine that most people in the military are by their very nature pacifists, largely because they're the ones that when the country decides it's not going to be pacifist anymore, they're the ones that get shot at and blown up, et cetera, and torn from their families. So, you know, I don't see there as being a conflict between being a pacifist and being in the military. The difference is the military just actually goes and does the work.
Right. I mean, I'll tell you, I know I don't want to, I'm not going to talk about my political leanings, but I was really worried when Occupy Wall Street was raging down here, that my unit might get called up to do some kind of – I'm in the Coast Guard, so we do waterways, federal waterways. But I was worried when they were going on the Brooklyn Bridge that we might be called to act on that. And when you're called, you go. I mean, you don't say no. You say no, that's very, very serious, and you can wind up in prison for it. So right. That was I was really glad that I did not have to deal with that choice.
Yeah. I'm glad you were glad.
I'm glad that you are glad that I was glad.
Okay.
Well, I organized a local Occupy movement, so I have to be glad that you were glad about that.
This is a very...
I know you're not sharing my political, your political leanings, but, you know, I'm still...
This is a very glad podcast.
Yes. We're very glad in this glad podcast. Okay, so I guess that, so we've kind of talked about a little bit about your military experience and your position in the military. And you mentioned that it did influence your writing, and I think to a lot of a certain extent it's very obvious because the story is set in the military. It's about military characters, etc. But what might your sort of military experience or life or things you whatever you experienced during that, how has that maybe influenced your work in a way that's not obvious?
Well, it hasn't in a way that's not obvious. Oh, wait a minute. You know, how do I say this without flattering myself? I'm fantastic. I think I like to think I have a lot more empathy and compassion for points of views that are different from my own. But that's less a result of being in the military and more of a result of going to Iraq. And being in war specifically. The whole idea of honor and being prickly and willing to get pissed off at somebody or get offended easily, Iraq really largely cured me of that. I'm about 100 times more easygoing as a result of that experience than I was before. And when you're writing characters that are nothing like yourself, Oscar Britton is a black kid from Vermont, and Teresa Delagua, who's the female lead in the story, is a Puerto Rican gal from L.A. You need to be able to empathize. I mean, this is what, in my opinion, the greatest writers, George R.R. Martin, Peter V. Brett, Joe Abercrombie, all of them have this amazing ability to step into the skins of people that are nothing like them and write them authentically and in a way that resonates. And... you know, I struggle with my own tendency towards being judgmental. I struggle with my own tendency of being dismissive. When you live in New York, boy, does that get exacerbated. But I really do think that having gone to Iraq advanced me in that regard and my ability to sort of sympathize with the plight of other people. And I like to think that that helps my writing.
That's a really interesting answer.
Thank you. I'm a very interesting guy.
I'm absorbing it for a moment, but I have to. Okay, so obviously, Britton, he is not you, but you know, he goes through a very sort of interesting struggle with his journey. In that he serves and he's very much, you know, the kind of the hardline military guy. And then he finds out that he is one of the people that the military isn't so happy with. And then he's forced to serve and he's struggling with the mission. And for a while he's good with the mission and then he's bad with the mission. How much of that is a struggle that's similar to anything that you may have gone through serving in Iraq?
I mean... all of it. And it's not just serving in Iraq, but it's serving in the military in general. I mean, right. You know, look, let me see if I can think of something here. I mean, one of the things, I'll give an example. One of the things the Coast Guard does is we do drug enforcement, right?
Right.
Which means invariably we wind up busting people for having a nickel bag of pot in their pocket. And I think that's ridiculous. And, you know, I really do think that there's a lot of people in prison because of silly things like that. And it's tough, but that is the law. And I raised my right hand and I said I would enforce it. And I said I would obey the orders of the superiors appointed over me. And integrity means doing what you say you're going to do, even when you don't like it, especially when you don't like it. And that example I gave of marijuana, I mean, obviously, I'm not happy with bales of it coming through on, you know, freighters being smuggled into the country. But, you know, some poor fisherman who's, you know, pulling an all-night shift with a nickel bag in his pocket, you know, God, it's, I feel almost bad that that guy's got to get busted. But that's the law. And you can't pick and choose what laws you're going to enforce when you're in that business, right? So that's an example of the kind of struggles I think that not just myself, but all kinds of people in the military have when they are called. I mean, I know plenty of people who got called for Iraq and Afghanistan, had problems with those missions. But you don't get to say, I'm not going to do this, or I don't want to do this, or I don't agree. It's extremely important that members of the military be instruments of policy. We have to be tools of the civilian government. Because if we start making policy, what do you have? You have a military junta, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is, I'm on the hot seat right now, so you're hearing about my struggle, but I would be real surprised if you ask anyone who serves in the military in any capacity if they don't have similar struggles. So yeah, I guess there's some of that in Britain from me, but I think that that experience is universal. Whenever you're responding to crises, you have to exercise snap judgments and move fast. And part of that involves acting on training and, moving in ways that maybe you have internal conflicts about.
But I mean, taken to a logical extreme, obviously you've pointed out kind of a simplistic sort of, you're not killing the guy with the, dime bag of marijuana. Britain's journey is much more of a logical extreme of that situation and much more mirrors what, happens in Iraq, where the indigenous people, so called in the book, the Indigs, and versus the people who are living in Iraq and everything, versus the actual terrorist groups and whatnot. And that he is called to kill these people, and he doesn't necessarily agree with that. And he rebels against it. But obviously that's something that can't work in a modern day military. If that happens, they're called, what is it? Not prisoner of war. God, now I'm like totally
traitors?
Missing up.
They're called traitors. Is what they're
traitors.
Called.
Thank you. That's
one of
the
few
word.
Things we have left where punishment is usually death by firing squad.
Yeah, right. So, and yet Britain is still, he's very much the hero of this story. So, I mean, how do you resolve that?
For one thing, I'm writing a fantasy. And for another thing, Britain is not me, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm a company grade officer in the United States military, and I will not brook disobedience to the commander's intent in my unit, ever. Nor will I act contrary to the commander's intent. I am very much the opposite of Britain in that regard. I take that extremely seriously, as I think do all officers who are worth their salt. I do my job first and foremost, and I have sworn, as we all have, that if that means my life, then so be it. And I'm not saying that as a dramatic flourish here. I mean it. But Britain, and also Britain, is faced with a far more dramatic and, for lack of a better word, bipolar situation than even I was in Iraq. I don't want to spoil the book, but he's not a guy with a whole lot of options. I think ultimately he's also the kind of person who's willing to take bigger risks than I think either myself or a lot of real people I know would be. And that kind of drama is what makes a compelling story. I mean, let's face it, if I was Britain, then Britain would have followed orders and done his job and done the government's bidding, and Control Point would probably never have sold because it wouldn't have been a very interesting book.
We'll get off of the military thing in a couple questions here, because we don't want to talk just about the fact that this is a military fantasy. One of the things that I'm very curious about, because in your book, your military it has women in combat. I mean, not very many of them, but they do exist in combat here. And we've recently had a discussion about women in the military, and in particular in genre fiction, even more particular in science fiction, but here we're dealing with fantasy. And I'm very curious, how do you think, that if in the future of whatever the military in general, that something like, say, a fantasy element like magic or something like technology will at some point bridge the gender gap, that we'll have a much more active female component in our military?
I don't think we're going to need that. The fact is that women are already in combat. the idea of a front in a war that women can be kept away from is a joke. And that ended, I mean, I won't go into military theory, but you guys can Google fourth generation warfare and read about it. I think the seminal author in that field is a guy, Thomas Hammes. What little nonfiction I've published has been on this topic. And you can, if you go to the products link on my website, and go down to my nonfiction, you can find links to articles I've written about fourth and fifth generation warfare theory. But anyway, the point being is that fronts are gone and that women are in combat and killed in combat all the time. And I think the military, as we saw with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, is an extremely sclerotic and rigid institution that is slow to change. But I think that change is coming. I think that and I don't think it's going to take any impetus other than the social mood, because, again, our military is an instrument of our government and our government roles at the will of the people that it represents. So I'd say that women in combat are inevitable. I do want to point out, have you guys read Naomi Novik's Temeraire series?
No, but I got my mother addicted to it.
How did you get your mother addicted to it if you never read it?
Oh, well, they did a promotion at the publisher about, like, you know, give a book to a friend. And so they gave my mom the first book, and she didn't know who'd sent it to her. And so she read it, got hooked, and then bought all the others in the series. And then at some point we had a conversation on the phone, and I was like, did you enjoy the book? And she's like, it was you bastard.
All right. Okay. So then I want everyone to take a nose oath with me. So I want you to put your fingers on your noses.
All right. Done.
Yep.
Got it, Sean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're not lying to me, all right, because we're not on video.
No, yeah. Not lying.
Does it matter which finger it is?
No. It just has to be a finger. All right. Now repeat after me. I. Sean, whatever my last name is.
Sean Duke.
Jen Bagley.
No, you have to say Sean Duke too, Jen Bagley.
Oh, okay. I, Sean Duke.
Will Reed.
Will Reed.
His Majesty's Dragon.
His Majesty's Dragon.
As soon as
humanly possible.
Okay.
As soon as humanly possible? Is that what we're going with?
Yeah. Now, and the reason I want to, not only because it's an awesome book and everyone's like, oh, Mike Cole, you know, you're doing this military fantasy thing. No one's ever done that. And I think maybe I hope I'm not flattering myself. I don't think anyone's done it the way I've done it, but Naomi Novik totally did it. The Temeraire series is a reimagining of the Napoleonic Wars with dragons, a dragon mounted aerial corps involved. It is so magnificently done. There's a critical species of dragon. I think they're the fire breathers or acid spitters, and they're called longwings, and they will only accept female captains. And
booyah!
And that turns Victorian society on its head, because now the military must appoint female officers, and female officers up to the rank of captain, which is a very high rank in the Navy, and the Navy rank structure is what applies to the aerial corps in the story. If you guys are interested in a really good fantasy treatment of that very topic, the Temeraire series is for you.
Well, guess who we're going to get on the show?
Actually, I'm on a panel with Naomi Novik on March 6th. So if you don't have her on the show by then, I will
order her to come on the show.
I have no influence over that woman at all. She is head and shoulders more popular than I am. So
that's good. This actually leads me to the next question, because I have not. This is the first. Okay, I can't say the first military fantasy, but the first modern military fantasy that I've ever read. And I almost think that it might be risky, only because most of the time people are willing to accept, you know, kind of the gritty and sort of moral questions and whatnot. If it's further removed from the contemporary space. Do you think that people will be receptive to this? Do you think it's one of those things that's like going to explode on the scene and then you're going to have a ton of modern military fantasy out there?
You have hit on my biggest fear and my biggest hope with this series. Control Point gathered a lot of rejections before Penguin finally bought it. And the rejections voiced exactly what you're describing. This book is unsure of its voice, which I took as code for we don't know who we're going to sell it to. Some marketing people flat out told me, yeah, we think that hard military stories sell to guys and high fantasy elegiac stories tend to sell more to women, and your story is going to sell to nobody. That's my biggest fear, is that it will not be able to net a wide enough audience. And my biggest hope is exactly that it will start a new genre, because I think it's an awesome and fun topic. I don't like the male-centric sort of, again, sclerotic hard lines that you see in military science fiction. There's sort of a closed group of dudes, mostly on Bane, the Bane label, that do it. I'd love to see it treated more expansive, because it's a fantastic topic. Now, what I'd really love to happen is for this to jump the genre track altogether and start appealing to straight up military readers, you know, people who like Vince Flynn and Tom Clancy. That would be an absolute dream come true. But yeah, I mean, when I lie awake at night, you guys have to remember, like, I quit my government job for life, so six-figure government job for life, to do this full time. And so it's a little nerve-wracking, you know. I really want this to work out. And the fact that I am kind of cutting maybe an unknown trail here is terrifying.
Well, I would hope so.
That it would be terrifying, or that you would succeed. Jeez, Jen.
That it would succeed, and that it's terrifying. I want him to lie awake at night sweating.
Well, you're getting your wish, Jen, so this is...
No, I mean, it really was interesting to go into this sort of the modern military urban fantasy. I've been reading military science fiction for years. Not a lot of it, but enough of it, and it's always been one of my favorite aspects of science fiction. And I love military-based fantasies, but... like I said, they're always kind of set in, I mean, even Naomi Novik, she's at least setting it back, you know, a couple hundred years. So it's in a nice, safe place. This book is not in a safe place.
Nope. It's, I mean.
At all.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people who are, I think, have experiences that will marry up to what's here. You know, it's funny. I got a buddy, my friend Ted, who's a Navy guy, RAC vet. And he came to New York City Comic Con to see me, and he picked up an ARC, and I was really, really nervous about his read on it, because if there's someone who's going to call me out, not just on factual errors, you know, and how the military is represented, but in terms of the larger experiential component, he's the guy. He liked it. He liked it, and he's been really supportive. But yeah, I mean, that stuff scares the heck out of me.
Well, I don't.
Yeah,
blame.
I mean, it seems like it's kind of a ripe sort of. Customer base right now. You've got a lot of people returning from Iraq, obviously. And, you know, will they want to read things that don't necessarily completely mirror their experiences, but are pretty close to home, I would imagine. And will the rest of the community pick it up? I wish you the best of luck, because I really enjoyed it. And I think, I mean, I know people who are into military in military history and military fiction that I'm sure will love this book, but they're also not necessarily those who are contemporary to the experience of the military either.
Yeah. So. I mean, you are speaking my language. Hey, as long as we're talking this military topic, can I plug some books? Not mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go for it.
So my two favorite military science fiction authors are Jack Campbell, author of the Lost Fleet series, and Robert Buettner, who is now one of the Bane crowd, but he started out on Warner Aspect. His first book is called Orphanage, and I actually did an appreciation of that book on Tor.com. But I think that both of those guys capture military complexity and strength of character in a way that I think is head and shoulders above the other ranks of military writers. And I would like to point out that both those guys are vets. Buettner was Army Intel, and Jack Campbell was Navy Intel.
Oh, Lost Fleet. I knew that sounded familiar. Mm-hmm. That book is awesome.
So you've read it?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I have.
So the first book in that series is Dauntless, which is fantastic. Hey, Sean, have you read any of the Lost Fleet books?
No, but I really want to.
Do you want to do a nose oath, or can I just trust you to?
You just have to trust me.
Okay. All right. Well, no more fingers on noses then, but I'm going to check up on that. So, all right. And then for military fantasy, the only person I know or keeps getting brought up is Glenn Cook's Black Company series. which is supposed to be have that same sort of gritty, but it's medieval. And then Joe Abercrombie's never called military fantasy, but if you read his book, The Heroes, it's the whole book is 3 days of a battle. And it's just one of the most magnificent works of fantasy I've ever read, and certainly of military fantasy, which I would certainly designate it as.
Okay.
Good to know. Everybody go read.
Am I allowed to plug something too?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, well, I just bought this book. I've looked at it at the Barnes & Noble like 3 times. It's from Bain, actually, and it's called Citizens, edited by John Ringo, and it's all short stories by veterans of war that are military science fiction. So I just thought people, since we're talking about this, it sounded cool.
Yeah, I saw that book, and I really want to read it, and I really want to be in the next anthology, Citizens 2.
Yeah, it sounded really cool, and so I bought it. And there's a lot of classic folks in there, and new people. It's good.
Awesome.
So why don't we take a big detour away from the military now, and let's start talking about magic, because magic is sexy. Let's just get it out there.
By the way, I loved. And it took me forever to figure this out, but I loved that GMAC is an anagram for magic.
It took
me forever to get that, but once I did, I was like, "Oh, that's awesome!"
Well, we've got a glossary in the back of that book, and a lot of people have told me. And it's funny, when I first wrote Control Point, I put the glossary in the front, and everyone was like, "No, glossaries go in the back." And so I let the glossary go in the back, and that was a bad move on my part, because I've had at least 5 people tell me I didn't even know the glossary was there. And it would have really helped me get into the story if I had had it to refer to.
Yeah, you find them more often in the beginning of books these days than you used to, but it's still a fairly rare thing. Well, usually it's like the introduction of people, though, not necessarily a glossary. So,
I
might have been helpful.
I do want to point out from Sean's statement that magic is sexy, that before the show, we had all agreed actually that large noses, in point of fact, were sexy.
Large noses are sexy. Magical noses, the sexiest.
Have you noticed, is it a coincidence, you think, that it has been a nose oath that we have been swearing throughout
this? No, not at all. I mean, if you have such a prominent nose, the best place to swear such an oath would be on it.
Right.
I suppose, right. Yes.
Right, and a little cultural fun fact here. When Americans indicate themselves, they point usually at their own chests. When folks in Japan, China, and Korea, to my experience, indicate themselves, they point at their nose, which is the most prominent feature on the body.
Huh.
Aside from boobs, of course.
You wouldn't go there, Jen. You would.
Jeez!
I'm allowed to go there. As a woman, it is the only one on this podcast at the moment who is allowed to go to those places. But I know you were both thinking it.
Sean, you told me before I agreed that this was going to be a boob-free podcast.
Maybe he was talking about the other kind of boob.
No, I meant Jen totally ruined it all.
You Thanks seriously promised him a boob-free podcast?
Yeah, but he promised me that I was going to get superpowers.
You're still going to get superpowers. You're just these kinds of things don't happen instantly, dude. You know, you gotta at least get to the end of the show.
Okay. I don't know, man. I've been waiting for 28 years.
You're 28?
Yeah, I'm old.
Oh my god, dude. How old does that make me?
Yeah, ancient.
Even older? You're past middle age, man.
You know, it's all downhill from here. This book is my last gasp at doing something significant with my life. I'll probably keel over in the next couple of years.
You can't. You've got 2 more books coming out.
Well, it's all right, though. The Fortress Frontier, the sequel, is done and turned in. I really only have to write one more. And I don't really know what to do. I've got about 20 pages of notes, which at some point I should sit down and start organizing.
And don't forget, you've got that romance novel that you have to write, so you can't die in the next 2 years.
Right.
Yep. You got to live at least another, like, 90.
Another 90 years?
Yeah, but by then we'll live...
Didn't we agree that you weren't going to die?
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Now we're bringing up stuff from before the podcast. You know, this is all. This is why I wanted you to record that.
Okay, so magic.
Right, magic.
Oh, so what was the impetus behind your magic system? Because it's fairly rigid. It's set in schools. Some of them are good. Some of them are bad. They're determined bad, although I guess it depends on where you live in the world whether they're bad. So what was sort of the impetus behind this particular magic system?
Okay, now this is something I feel really strongly about. And yeah, I do want to add to that, Sean. There are no good or bad. There's no moral judgments attached to schools of magic in the Shadow Ops universe. There are simply schools that have been rendered illegal by certain governments and others who are signatories to an amendment to the Geneva Convention. But that's sorry, I'm distracted by
I'm sorry
popping up chat messages. Jen, you ruin everything. Okay, so the magic. One thing I want to point out again: two books here, or two series rather. The first is Patrick Rothfuss's King Killer Chronicles, which includes The Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear. I know you heard of that, right?
Yep.
Yes.
And then the second one is Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn series, and I'm pretty sure you've heard of that, right?
Yep, we've heard of it.
Okay, so I loved the King Killer Chronicles, and one of the things I admired about both series is that the magic systems are so incredibly well supported. They're almost sciences. I've said in the past that Pat Rothfuss is a chemist. That's actually not true, as I found out when I was at Confusion, but he does know a lot about chemistry. And you'll see a basis for that in his sympathy system in his books. Because the magic systems are so incredibly well researched, and because the parameters that govern them are so clearly defined and made available to the reader, there is no deus ex machina in the story. There's no sudden unknown thing that can come out and save the characters, right? Because the reader knows the rules, the contract between author and reader in terms of how the magic systems work has been established, and the author religiously adheres to it. Well, the awesome thing about that is when the reader knows what's up and the reader knows how everything works, then the author can really hold the protagonists in the story at risk. And the reader can really be like, oh my God, how's he going to get out of this? Because he knows that how magic works, or he or she knows how magic works and how it's going to affect that protagonist. When I developed the magic system in the Shadow Ops series, I really wanted to have that same degree of rigor. And I'll be frank, I don't think I achieved it. Anyone who's seen how well thought out Sympathy is, or Allomancy in the Mistborn series, there's just no way that my magic system holds up to it. But it was certainly influenced with that goal. I want the reader to understand how magic works, to understand its limits, and to understand when the protagonists are in deep trouble as a result.
Well, that was an interesting way to answer that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So it had nothing to do with the fact that you were setting this in a military world.
Oh, no. No, no. I mean, the whole point, again, was that the Shadow Ops series is about the military suddenly having to come to grips with the existence of magic. They don't get to dictate how magic happens. Because, I mean, this is the thing. It's kind of like cyber warfare today. I mean, the military has sort of been sitting around twiddling its thumbs while, I mean, even though they are responsible for the internet, they were sort of not early embracers the way that, frankly, the nerd community has been. And cyber warfare sort of took off with the military kind of being behind. With the creation of Cybercom, they're doing a heck of a lot better. But all of a sudden, they have to deal with this strange new power that's moving along faster than they intended. And what does the military do when it comes in contact with things that are strange and new? It wraps it up in red tape, makes it incredibly boring, and right? So
yes, codifies it.
Right. So I needed magic to be the same way. I needed it to be wild and untamable and strange, and then this high-bound, rigid, conservative bureaucracy to be like, oh my God, we got to get this locked down. And that's the McGower-Lyndon Act, and that's the Senate Subcommittee on the Great Reawakening, and that's the Supernatural Operations Corps. Those systems are a government evolving to cope with what it perceives to be a threat to the existential security of the nation.
But the magic system itself still has very specific things that each person can sort of manipulate within that system. You know, the Britain has portals. He doesn't have the whispering, for instance. But you do have things crop up, like the fact that the Terramancers can do the whispering as well. However, for the most part, it seems that each subset of powers is just that. It's a specific power base, which in the end seems kind of like an easy thing for the military to codify.
And they do. The McGower-Lyndon Act and the amendment to the Geneva Convention are very specific about what elemental spheres. I mean, in the end, my magic system works on elements. And it works on how those elements are conducted through the limbic systems in the brains of those people who come up latent. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you guys remember when, maybe a minor spoiler, but when Britain is thrown in the hole with Scylla, she talks to him about that. And they have a little chat about how magic works. So the military absolutely does move along those lines. But for me, that was less about the military and more about that Rothfussian, Brandon Sandersonian goal of creating a magic system with hard parameters that the reader could grip and grip quickly. One of the epigraphs in the book at the beginning of a chapter is a wallet card, which explains to the reader, hey, here are the magic systems in my universe.
Yeah, it's on page 38.
Wow. Oh, well done.
Just so I have it open.
And that wallet card, I mean, I did that on purpose. You know, I want the reader. What I hate is when you're reading a book and you know, by page 300, you're still getting possession of the universe. I want the reader to have their hand on the universe right away so they can just follow the characters and enjoy the story and understand how everything works. It's a little easier for me because it's set in modern times, but those hard parameters in the magic system really helped me to lay that out quickly.
Yeah, and I think it does help because, you know, one of the things I noticed, like, you know, when somebody writes a mystery or whatever, but it's set in a fantasy world, we spend so much time trying to understand the fantasy world so that we can get to the mystery. Whereas with a mystery novel set, you know, today, you don't get that because, you know, they're writing about a place that actually exists and writing about cultures that actually exist. So in having this, you know, you've got a world that actually exists, but then you have a system of magic which has existed for a while in the book, or seemingly for a little while. And then you have all of these elements which sort of help lock it down so that we understand that they're, even though there's all this weird new magic-y stuff, there's still like a natural order that's kind of come into being, and we get to see that fairly early on.
Yeah, and the Greek conception of elements, earth, air, wind, and fire, that's something that's intuitive in the Western consciousness. Like, I mean, when you say that, everyone knows. And there, you know, you don't even have to do a lot of explaining. So it helps the reader get possession. And then you throw in a few more schools, and, you know, people are like, oh, you know, it works by elements. You know, he's an aeromancer. Well, he must be able to fly. And what else can you do in the air? You know, lightning bolts, that sounds right. You know, and little things like when I describe the logo of the sock that's on the side of the Kiowa, that the insertion helicopter that they're flying in on, all of those things are deliberately intended to give the reader, you know, possession of how that magic system works.
And then you go through the process of, you know, throwing them into school so that the reader has even more of a training process before they're thrown into the more in-depth story sort of elements of the indigenous people versus the military and whatnot. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the military experience. Everything is training.
Yeah.
I have a question.
No, Sean, you may not ask your question.
Okay.
No,
okay,
go ahead. Go ahead.
I want to know about
these instead.
McGower and Lyndon people. Where did they go to school?
Senators McGower and Lyndon go to school?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, that's not something I have ready to hand. I never wrote the life stories of McGower and Lyndon. It's funny when I was telling the story of Control Point. I mean, Senators McGower and Lyndon are no longer in Congress at the time that the story is told. So I have from them the history textbook page in my head, and it's not an in-depth bio. I do know that they are the important senators that enacted that law, which basically got control of the Great Reawakening and set up the system of magical governance that exists in America at the time of the story. But in terms of their staffer bios, I think I'll have to go write those.
Okay. This is really a roundabout way of saying they just went to Harvard. And you just don't want to admit that even in your universe, your senators are all elitists.
You know, just as the military is a cross-section of society, so is the United States Congress.
Sure it is.
I was just being silly.
I should also remind folks of Article 88 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which states that commissioned officers in the military may not speak ill of cabinet-level officials.
Oh.
I love that rule. It's always been one of my favorites.
When I was my last tour, I was actually in Baghdad when Obama got inaugurated, and I spent a lot of time evoking Article 88 and saying, "Sir, you can't say that, sir. No, sir, can't say that, sir. That's the president, sir. Can't say that, sir."
Well, I mean, it serves a dual purpose. It protects people from opinions that they disagree with, and...
Well, and the military is just not supposed to be making those determinations. The military is the long arm of the state, you know, and it serves the interests of the nation. And really, it's kind of bad form if, you know, your upper level officers are saying, "I hate the president," or anyone is saying, "I hate the president," because that's a person you go, "Wait a minute, your judgment seems there's problems here."
Right. And this is why, you guys remember when McChrystal had to resign way back?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I worked with McChrystal. I mean, he's an amazing, amazing guy, and I have a tremendous amount of respect and admiration for him, but he's lucky he didn't wind up in Leavenworth. I mean, that is, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that is illegal.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
So does that apply even to fictional senators? Just teasing.
You want to know if I agree with McGowan and Lyndon? You know, like I said, all I have is a history textbook page to go off of.
No, I'm just teasing you. I was actually really curious, though, since we're talking about the legal aspects of this. Your novel sort of, you know, we have magic. It springs up and society scrambles to figure out what the hell to do with it. And your novel sort of brings up one of these kind of famous tropes that you've seen in comics and maybe more familiar with people who've watched the X-Men movies recently of, you know, the idea of the people who get power suddenly become the oppressed and the ostracized, or they're being compartmentalized by society, and there's more rigid rules for how to deal with them. And it's very interesting because I think Scylla is kind of like your version of Magneto, although she's a female, she has more powers, and she's a lot creepier.
Dude, you nailed it. When I and it's so funny because when I did the first version of the story, Peter V. Brett, have you guys read his Demon Cycle, The Warded Man, The Desert Spear?
No, but I have The Warded Man, and okay. I need to read it. It's on my shelf.
Jen?
No, I have not read it.
Okay.
I apologize.
Are we doing a nose oath, or?
Okay. Well, we should get him on this show, actually.
To read whatever book that you just said, because everything's going robot on my end anyway, so.
Okay, The Warded, first of all, I don't know, I mean, it's no mystery that Peter Brett is my dearest friend and a mentor to me, and but I say this all the time, even if we were bitter enemies, I still think he's one of the finest writers in fantasy out there, and you're crazy not to read him. But when the manuscript at the time was called Latent, was failing, and I was needing to rewrite it, Scylla was a somewhat different character. She was a lot angrier and doing a lot more lashing out. And I mean, she had been robbed of her life by the Sock, and she was pissed about it. And a lot of those attributes I transferred onto Swift, who now sort of occupies that role. And one of the exact things that Pete said to me was, "Mike, you know, you should really make Scylla, your Magneto." That was his exact words. And when he said that, the bell went off in my head. I wrote that scene with Britain and Scylla in the hole together, and she became a tremendous linchpin around which the new version of the book came together. And I really think it's one of the reasons it sold. So when you said that she's my Magneto, you don't have no idea how psychic that that statement was. She's absolutely my Magneto.
Do you think there's a particular reason? Because these kinds of ideas of this oppression, they kind of spring up a lot. Do you think that is there's something about our culture or about our way of thinking as fictional people that compels us towards that particular line?
I think that's all cultures and all peoples. I think that any societies are based around enfranchised people who have embraced a social order, right? And any cosmopolitan society has groups of people that are living under that umbrella that don't embrace that social order. I mean, that's always the case in every culture on Earth. And those societies that don't embrace, those subgroups that don't embrace the social order or come from a different social order or want changes in the existing social order are always at odds with the people that are in charge. And historically in this country, we have reacted to preserve our power through not the nicest ways. And some people would argue that that's still going on now. So I think that this idea of oppression and of disenfranchised social groups, especially those groups that are new and have some kind of potential upsetting power, is one that is familiar to anyone in any country from any period of history. I don't think I'm doing anything new there.
All righty. Totally just throw that question back in my face. Thank you.
These are good. Now, I got to say, guys, and by guys, I mean one of you isn't.
Yeah.
These are awesome, awesome questions. I'm really you're really making me think here. I'm enjoying this a lot.
Oh, well, you're welcome. We try to be awesome.
And I also, I mean, the fact that I'm talking to human beings is another real plus.
Do you not normally talk to human beings?
No, I normally sit in my apartment or, you know, sit in the coffee shop. Twitter is my girlfriend, sad to say.
I was just making sure that you weren't talking to some other sort of species on a regular basis.
Like your vacuum cleaner.
The vacuum cleaner.
Having conversations. Exactly. What did you do today, Hoover?
Like Wilson from Castaway?
Yeah, only, you know, it's... But maybe, you know, maybe you would do the dialogue for the vacuum. I'm trying to think of what the vacuum would say back.
Life sucks.
Did you guys ever see Teletubbies? You have kids, Jen.
Yes, I have seen Teletubbies.
I've had many nightmares.
I actually banned my children from watching that show pretty quickly because I realized it wasn't so much a show for kids. It was more for stoned adults. But yes, I have seen Teletubbies.
So this is but you then know of the vacuum creature that just sort of runs around the base.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I got one of those.
Creepy.
I want one of those.
Hey, wow. We've only been on the air for an hour and 1 minute and 5 seconds, and I've already been accused of being creepy. This is a world record. I've never gone.
It usually takes you more than an hour to be accused of being creepy?
No, it usually takes me less, substantially.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, Jen, you are a female. We've been talking for, if we count being offline, almost an hour and a half, and you have not yet taken out a restraining order, so I think...
I have a very high tolerance for creepy.
Well, as we knew last episode...
I have mentioned my large-nosed husband, have I not?
You have.
Sick.
Okay, so I have a silly question for you.
Okay. I have a silly answer.
Oh, I'm sure you do. What the hell is up with the goblins and sugar? It's like crack cocaine for goblins.
They are nuts, man. And I mean, I think I'm taking this one directly from the Native American experience. Have you guys seen the movie Black Robe? I keep throwing out these pop culture references, and then making
that missing completely, which is even worse somehow. Yeah, Black Robe. Yes. Okay.
Did you see it?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Great. I've not seen it, no.
I'm kind of obsessed with the Native American experience because I'm a white person with guilt, so...
All right. Well, Sean knows of...
Okay.
Yes, you definitely have to watch it.
All right. So Black Robe, the thing I like about Black Robe is it talks about... We keep thinking of the European experience with Native Americans as a land grab motive where they're seeking to colonize, but what people don't realize is when the Dutch and the Portuguese first came here, they saw America as a wilderness that they didn't want to have anything to do with. They wanted to trade and make money, mostly for fur, but they didn't want to live here. And the Haudenosaunee Empire, which we now know as the Iroquois, the Longhouse tribes that were on the East Coast, the introduction of glass and sugar and firearms upset the balance of power between those nations and caused the we've heard Last of the Mohicans, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they were wiped out not because their land was being taken, but because, you know, they were killing each other to expand their trapping operations so they could trade pelts for sugar and coffee and glass that they'd become dependent on to get through harsh winters and to have a higher quality of life. So that story, I never forgot it. And it really, really had currency with me. And when I had goblins in the United States Army interacting in the source, I thought, of course, you know, there's a lot of parallels I was drawing from the interaction of the U.S. Army and Iraqi natives that I was dealing with. But that I drew directly from that idea of the American Indian experience in the early, early days of first contact with Europe.
Well, and now that's interesting because you directly tie the goblins who have a very, you know, similar experience to Native Americans in our history, to the Sulphur Indian tribes that are operating in the United States as well.
I don't want to give you any spoilers. There's a lot more of that. There's more of it in Fortress Frontier and a hell of a lot more of it in Breach Zone. So I will say no more because I don't. We really will reveal to the readers what's going on.
Excellent. Awesome. I just wanted to verify that.
Verified.
Awesome. I did really like that part. You ended one of your chapters, and I thought it was brilliant how you ended it. Was I can't remember the exact line because I don't remember the exact page, but it's a, you know, they just land and they had this big battle on this other plane, and the guy says, you know, well, you don't know what's going on, you know, we're invading the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that line.
Thank you. And that line is, I believe that's Downer's line. She's saying it.
Yeah. So, yeah. I'll have to find it.
I didn't even pick up on that.
Well, Jen, hopefully you find things through the book that will lead you to say, Mike, you're really brilliant.
I had many things that led me to believe that. Unfortunately, I read the book like a month ago and then I had to think of questions with migraine. So I was just kind of sitting here going,
Hey, I get migraines.
I do that a lot, though.
I get migraines too, and I want your listeners, to know that two things work for me, and one is hot baths, because it moves blood around the body, I guess. And if that's not reliable, but what has never failed me is over the counter Excedrin migraine. Two of those.
Yes, agreed, absolutely.
Yep.
And I'm glad you're dispensing medical advice to our listeners, because I think we have definitely run the gamut of topics now.
As your listeners know, I am a doctor.
Yeah. Page 132.
I don't think they knew that.
Just so everybody knows.
I'm not a doctor. I'm kidding.
That's awesome. And it is Downer. Yeah, she does say it. We're conquering the Magic Kingdom. I laughed, but I was also a little depressed by that at the same time. It was a very weird moment.
Well, I would have been depressed too, because there weren't any castles or princesses and whatnot. No Cinderella, so...
Well, I want to point out that the source is truly the Magic Kingdom. I mean, there's everything there, and you're going to see more of it in Fortress Frontier. So who knows? There may be a castle with a princess trapped in a tower guarded by a dragon just for you.
Yay!
You should name the dragon, like, after us. You should make an amalgam of our names.
How about, I got an idea, how about Shawnee Jen?
That sounds like the worst dragon name ever.
He'd have so many self-esteem problems.
What are you talking about? That dragon would, and I'll tell you what, for terms of efficiency in like business email, you can't think of a better dragon name.
I can.
Well, don't.
I'm like, wait, no, I definitely could probably think of a better dragon name. I suppose not off the top of my head, and not as an amalgamation of our two names, but...
Oh, no, I got
just
one.
Just not cut it. Oh, do you? You already have one.
No, it's Sean, but here's the thing. Like, if you say it, and then I decide to name the dragon that later, and the book becomes a New York Times bestseller, you're going to sue me.
Oh, that's true.
I won't sue you.
Well, that's good, as long as it's only Sean suing me instead of the two of you pooling your money to hire an army of lawyers.
What is his name? The name of the dragon from Dragon Slayer.
God, man. That is so... How do you even know that? You're 12. How do you remember that movie?
I have it on DVD.
So do I. Yeah.
Did you guys see Dragon Heart with Sean Connery doing the voice of the dragon?
Yes, I enjoyed that one. Hated the second version, of course, but...
I really liked the first one. I thought the first one was great.
My favorite dragon film was actually the one with Christian Bale, though. So,
Vermithrax.
Vermithrax? No.
That's the name of the dragon from Dragon Slayer.
Well, then the Dragon Slayer people will be suing him, too.
I know.
So
I'm just saying that's a badass name. I was saying
I think all the Dragon Slayer people are dead by now.
Except for like the main actor who was like 12. No, that guy. The guy who was in it. He was in... Ally McBeal, and he was in Ghostbusters.
Who?
The young kid.
Yeah, he was
the creepy guy in Ghostbusters who like had the painting, and he became Vigo's like slave master and tried to steal the baby.
Yeah,
that creepy guy. And then in Ally McBeal, he was I forget. He was also in Numbers.
Guys, we are talking about Ally McBeal.
Yes, we are.
Now, first of all,
only because that guy ran, like, he literally was in everything.
No. I was promised a boobless podcast. That oath has already been broken.
You know what? I never made that promise. So you're just gonna have to get it.
I want that promise to be expanded to an Callista Flockhart-less podcast.
I can definitely get behind a Callista Flockhart-less.
Hey,
I, however, always insist on there being boobs.
Wait, the Christian Bale movie, was that Rain and Fire with Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah, Rain of Fire, yes. That was.
That movie sucked.
It really did.
Shut up! It did not!
It did! That was the worst
movie. Gerard Butler and Christian Bale in the same movie. It was the sexiest movie that was ever made.
No.
Well, that's what's going on here. It's a... and by the way, you have to let me tell my Christian Bale story now.
Uh-oh. Go on.
So, my friend Matt, who writes a great webcomic strip called No Hobo, which you should totally Google and read. It's awesome. He's also done a comic book called Division 18 for an independent label. So he's sort of another creative type. He calls me one day and he's like, Mike, they're doing an open casting call for the new Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises. And they're soliciting specifically for military and law enforcement. And I go, dude, I don't want to do that. You know, I'm gonna have to stand online, you know, 20,000 people wrapped around the block. And, you know, and he's like, dude, you have to do it. No, none of us could do it. And we all want to be in a Batman movie. And you got to take one for the team. So I caved, and I was just like I expected. I'm on this line of, I'm not exaggerating, I'm guessing 20,000 people looped around the block. And, you know, like after an hour, I have to pee. And I call him and I'm like, dude, I'm not staying on this line. I have to go pee. And he lit me up on the phone. You know, you got to suck it up. You know, we're all counting on you. And so I get into this casting room like an hour later, you know, doing the pee-pee dance. And
Why didn't you bring a bottle with you?
Yeah, right. Because in the middle of New York, that's a great idea. Out on the street.
Because it's never been done before in New York.
Well, shoot, in New York, they don't bother with a bottle, right? They just sort of go for it.
Exactly.
And in like the corners of the subway stations. So, and then they go, you know, they take your information, they take a photograph of you, and they go, "We'll call you," and which in Hollywood means we will not call you. And they called me, and I got 6 days of work out of it, 2 days of fight training, and I was part of this group that they called the Tigers. We were like principal fight extras that formed this ring around the stars for these major fight scenes. And then the other hoi polloi of the extras were further out. So I was for 6 days working 16 hours a day, getting the crap kicked out of me because – you know, when you're doing theatrical fighting, you miss a lot. And by miss, I mean hit. And I was, you know, 5 feet away from Christian Bale as Batman and Tom Hardy as Bane while they were fighting. And like as my head was whipping to the side from a simulated uppercut, I'm practically bumping into this guy's shoulder.
So basically what you're telling us is that your next big work is Batman The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd be shocked if I was even in the camera shot. I mean, there were literally the one scene I was in. I think there were 1,100 extras fighting. I'm a thug, so, and I'm wearing a black knit cap and like fingerless hobo gloves and a ripped leather jacket, and I have an AK-47 strapped across my back, so maybe you could spot me that way. I'm fighting a Gotham cop.
Oh my gosh. Jen, we will watch that movie over and over in theaters when it comes out we find out exactly the moment in the film when Mike is in it.
Yeah, you know.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm part of a crowd of 1,100 people. I mean, you may be, and it's out, we'll tell you this, it's out of doors. It was shot on the steps of the New York City Stock Exchange, so it's like white stone steps.
I've seen stills of that scene.
Right, well, I'm in there somewhere.
Oh, right, we'll find you.
No, he will.
I'll find you. I will kick a screen cap, and I will
Mike,
zoom
I
it in.
I love you, but not spending
can,
that much money
Sean,
on.
Can you do me a favor? Did you see Last of the Mohicans?
Yes, I did.
With Daniel Day-Lewis, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember the scene where he sort of husks to his love interest, "No matter what occurs, I will find you.
I will find
you."
Yeah.
Would you say that to me?
Come on, Sean.
No.
I don't think
my girlfriend would appreciate that.
This podcast sucks.
But I'm serious. I'm gonna I'm gonna blow it up and put it on a thing that says, you know, Mike Cole, action star.
Well, I will tell you this. when we got done, since I now have 2 days, apparently regular extra is the bottom rung of a career ladder that leads to actor. And fight extra is the bottom rung of a career ladder that leads to stuntman. So I did tell the casting agency, which is the biggest one, and you know they handle all the movies in New York. I was like, look, if you want me to do more work, because they were giving me a pretty good rate because of the military experience, I'll do it again. I have no desire to be in film, but it's good money. And when you're a starving full-time writer, good money's a hard thing to pass up.
I'll remember that when I need some people for the movie I'm going to make one day.
I'll be your I'm happy to get the crap kicked out of me in your movie, Sean.
Awesome. Sweet. Okay, so we got to kind of get things closed out. So what have you got coming out? Because you've got a new book coming out next year. But what have you got coming out, say, in the next 9 months or so? The convention appearances, those kinds of things. Where can tell us?
Oh my God, there's so much. On the writing front, you know, Fortress Frontier is done and turned in. Breach Zone, I'm writing. I did an essay for an upcoming anthology called Beyond the Wall, which is an essay of nonfiction analyzing George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. I wrote an essay for that about post-traumatic stress disorder and its impact on the principal characters in the story. So I don't know when that's coming out, but hopefully not too long. I'm also currently editing a novelette in the hopes that a certain very large media tie-in franchise will be picking it up with the goal of writing novels in that franchise. But obviously I'm not going to say which because they may not hire me, and I really hope they do. I'm trying to get in with video games. I'd love to write for comic books. I have another original series trilogy ready to go and a standalone novel pitch ready to go. So I'm maybe working on a collaboration with another author. So there's all kinds of irons in the fire. We'll see what actually comes to pass. In terms of publicity, February 1st, I'll be on reddit.com/r/fantasy, the Reddit fantasy AMA, Ask Me Anything event. And if you go to reddit.com/r/fantasy, you can see the announcement for that. It's also on the SITREP. I want to encourage your listeners to go to the SITREP tab, SITREP tab on my website. That has all of my upcoming appearances. February 2nd, which is a Thursday at 6:30 p.m., I'll be doing a signing of Control Point at Posman's in Grand Central Station in New York City. February 7th, I will be doing a reading at the Soho Digital Gallery of Art along with debut novelist Saladin Ahmed, who's novel Throne of the Crescent Moon is coming out within weeks of mine, from Penguin. And Bob Howe will be joining us there too. He's also a Coast Guard guy, so there'll be a Coast Guard theme to that. I will be doing a signing on February 15th at Quantico Marine Corps Base in Quantico, Virginia, at the main exchange there, starting at 11 a.m. I will be at BossCon, which I believe is the weekend of February 18th in Boston. But I'm also going to be attending a lot more conventions: Balticon, Lunacon, World Fantasy Con, probably Dragon Con, San Diego Comic Con, and New York Comic Con if I can make them both. So if you want to find me to use that Last of the Mohicans line that I asked you for, Sean, there's lots of opportunities in the near future.
Oh, it's not going to happen. That's a little.
Would you please slow down slightly? I think you're making the rest of the world look bad.
We talked about creepy, did we not, earlier in the show?
That had nothing to do with creepy. I'm just feeling like my life is sad all of a sudden.
Wait a minute. You don't think that my asking Sean to say that line from The Last Mohicans is just a little bit creepy?
Oh, no, that's
it's a little,
totally normal.
It's a little bit creepy.
That seems pretty reasonable to me. I mean, after all, he did vow to search you out.
Right.
By watching the movie over and over again.
I'm not willing to make this a romantic proclamation. That's
all I'm saying.
If anything is creepy, it's Sean.
All I want is drama in life. Why is that? Big thing to ask. Anyway, the SITREP page, SITREP, go to www.mikecole.com. That's Mike with a Y, MYKECOLE.com. Click on SITREP. And you will see all of my news and appearances.
Awesome. Fabulous. Cool. So obviously then we know where people can go to find you. It's MikeCole.com, Mike with a Y. And that's also your Twitter handle. It's just your name, Mike Cole.
Right. And if you go to Facebook.com/MikeCole, MYKECOLE.com, you'll find me there.
I'm so glad. Awesome. That means that we can stalk you.
I'm delighted to be stalked. It means it's the closest I've ever come to having friends.
Aww.
I find that hard to believe.
Oh,
you're such a
Sean.
You're such a like exciting guy. I can imagine people like enjoying hanging around you.
Dude, after about 5 minutes, they're like, "Shut up."
We can solve that with alcohol.
No, alcohol makes.
No, that was, yeah, seriously, Sean. I mean, you've heard the two, you and I talking when we have alcohol in us. That's just, no.
Now you get mad at me, Jen, because I'm still coherent after a few drinks.
That's true.
Do not give me alcohol. That's okay. A terrible idea.
I'll give you downers. Sorry. Well, that about does it. So thank you so much for coming on and talking with us for as long as you have.
Yeah, man. Anytime. This is like the one social contact I get a year, so I greatly appreciate it. Thanks for putting up with me.
Hey, no problem. It was awesome having you. So if anybody wants to send us messages, you now know how to get a hold of Mike in case you want to beg him to sign your book or find out where he's going to be so you can stalk him and bring him like old rabbit's feet and tell him they're good luck charms or something.
Hey, this is me talking again. Jump in. If folks want me to sign their books, they can shoot me an email at mike@mikecole.com, again, with the Y's. You don't have to ship me your book. I have sticker book plaques made up with both the sock logo and the shadow coven logo. I'll personalize it. Just give me your address. Tell me what you want on there, and I'll send it to you, postage and envelope or on me. So if you've got a book or an e-reader you want signed, I will do that for you.
Has he drawn us a Viking amoeba yet?
Yep. It's going to go up later tonight.
Oh, fantastic.
Tonight being the day we're recording, which is a Monday. I'm going to put that up tonight, and then I'm going to make the episode go up tomorrow because I don't want the episode to release too late in the evening because I like it to get
But isn't the book getting released tomorrow?
Yep. As a matter of fact, my plan, I'm going to go to bed tonight. I'm going to get up at the crack of 7, 8 tomorrow, and I'm going to hit every single physical bookstore that I can and sign all the shelf stock that they have. Lucky for me, there are basically no bookstores left anywhere in the world, so that should be a very quick day.
Cool. So if anybody wants to contact us, send us hate mail, which we can forward anonymously to Mike or not because we never get hate mail. You can easily do that or leave a comment or let us know whatever. A number of ways you can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
Twitter.
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
Or leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Yeah, we do have a .com. I'm sorry, Mike. You don't know the joke, but I switched them up on purpose to get Jenna.
I mean, it was bad enough. It took me forever to even figure out what all of them were in the first place, mostly because I don't pay any attention to Sean. And then I finally get it figured out, and he starts switching them up. It's really kind of obnoxious.
Jen, why can't you – I mean, like, why don't you just write them down and have, like, a sticky note in front of your face? You don't have to memorize it. It's radio.
That would be much too efficient.
Yeah. So cool. So thanks again, Mike, for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mike.
Yep. Appreciate it.
We will, of course, this will be plugged and everything, and your beautiful book will be up there, and your Viking amoeba, all that. And we will, of course, hopefully have more interesting stuff in the future.
Yeah.
Probably not. But we will have you on the show again.
Hey, guys, anytime. And seriously, if I can use my limited influence to net you another speaker or get you free books or whatever, you just let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. We love having guests. They're friendly. So, all right. So that about does it for our show. So we will see everybody at another time.
All right.
Next week, I would hope. Yep. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah.
I will find you. Bye.
Bye.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.